It's Central Time. I'm Dean Kinetter, in for Rob Ferret. You're with us on the Ideas Network. Coming up, we'll talk about summertime sandwiches for this week's edition of Food Friday. First, we all have people in our lives we disagree with. Maybe you have a close friend who has a different opinion on gun rights, or a family member who disagrees with you on pandemic safety measures. Talking about those disagreements can be really hard. And a lot of times, those conversations turn into arguments, and both parties end up more dug into their beliefs. Our next guest says that's because we're trying to go about changing someone's mind all wrong. He says it is possible to persuade someone, but facts and logic won't get us very far. We want to hear what you think at 800-642-1234. How do you handle conversations when you disagree with someone? Do you try to argue your point with facts? Has your own mind ever been changed on an issue? If so, how did that change happen? We want to hear from you. 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. David McRaney is a science journalist and the host of the You Are Not So Smart podcast. He's written multiple books, including his latest, How Minds Change, The Surprising Science of Belief, Opinion, and Persuasion. David, thanks for being here.
Oh, wow. Thank you so much for having me.
Well, this book was a bit of a personal journey for you. You admit at the start that you were someone who didn't always think it was possible to change a lot of minds. What started changing for you and getting you interested in persuasion?
Oh, yeah. Well, you know, I've run my podcast for like more than a decade now, and I've written about this for a long time. It's been my beat for a while to talk about biases, fallacies, heuristics, and motivated reasoning, judgment, decision-making, all of the psychology and social science, neuroscience that goes into that. And motivated reasoning is, there's a sort of cynicism that can go along with studying that for too long, I think. And I had become very pessimistic about it. The inciting moment for me, those two things combined. I was doing a lecture and someone asked me after the lecture, they said, I have a family member who is falling into a conspiracy theory. What can I do about it? And I told them, nothing, you can't do anything about it. And I didn't even believe it as it came out of my mouth. I didn't like the tone. I didn't like what I was suggesting. And also realized I didn't know enough about the prescriptive side of everything. I was all description, no prescription. So I wanted to dig into that more and give a better answer going forward. And I wish I could get a time machine and go back. But the other thing that happened was, while I was saying that, also the norms around same-sex marriage, the attitudes in the United States were changing very rapidly. And I looked at the polling, and 60% of the country just a few years earlier had been opposed, and now 60% was in favor of same-sex marriage. And I imagined what would happen if you took all of those people in the majority and sent them back 10 years and they had them meet themselves. They would argue, they would debate, they'd get mad at each other. They would refuse to change their minds in the presence of their own selves. And I just wondered, what's that all about? Not only what's going on in the brain when we disagree, but what happened in the interim so that a person after all of that could look back and say, oh yeah, of course I was wrong about that. That was available to them at any time, but something happened to lock it into place. That's what led me down this whole path. And yeah, I really did change my mind. There's a lot of comeuppance in this book about reaching out to people who resist and using better methods and so on.
And something that you found might at first be discouraging to us, and that's that facts, logic, not gonna always work. What are we getting wrong when we try to use those facts and logic?
Yeah, I think about this a lot. You know, there's a lot of frustration, especially right now, because we spend so much time arguing on the internet. And as I say in the book, I think that's good. I think that's a good thing we're all arguing. But the way in which we argue in a lot of our contexts is really poorly done. And we have this intuition about how to reach out to other people. I feel like that frustration should be directed at ourselves more than the other party. It's like trying to reach the moon with a ladder. And then when you fail, saying, well, the moon's unreachable. It's the technique that you're using. It's the approach that you're using. One of the things that makes this not work is that we all start with a motivation, and we go from that motivation, that emotion, that identity, that desire, that drive. We look at all the information available to us, and we cherry pick what seems to justify the feeling that we have, and then that becomes our collection of reasons for why we think, feel, and believe something. And when we meet someone who sees things differently, feels differently, we often take something out of that collection and say, this is why I think this, but that's not why you think it. That's a justification that you arrived at later. The reason why you think and feel this, maybe something that you aren't even really aware of. That's also happening on the other side. They've done the same thing and they have their collection. And if you just battle it out at the level of those conclusions, at those reasons, those justifications and rationalizations, you never get at why do you feel this way? What causes you to choose that and not something else? Why are you selectively skeptical? So I advocate for it throughout the book that you, instead of facing off against people in that way, get out of the debate frame, the I have to win, you have to lose, someone's right, someone's wrong, and instead try to get shoulder to shoulder, where the goal is invite the other person to participate in a team up exercise to investigate a mystery together, which is, why do you think we might disagree about this? And there's a lot more, everything that I talk about in the book, all the different persuasion techniques, all the people that I've met, even the people that have left conspiratorial communities and cults and pseudo cults, this is the technique, this is the conversational approach that delivers the results. Because we all can change our minds, and we all do update our assumptions and attain other points of view when it's presented in a certain way, when it avoids this reactance, as they call it in psychology. And that's the better path. It's not a book about how to win friends and influence people. It's a very different approach from that sort of manipulation, coercion way of doing things. It's a very different way of approaching another mind that sees things differently.
We're talking with David McRaney right now, a science journalist, host of the You Are Not So Smart podcast, and author of the new book, How Minds Change, The Surprising Science of Belief, Opinion, and Persuasion. We're talking about how minds do change and how you can go about it in your own life. And we want to hear what you think at 800-642-1234. When you have people you disagree with, how do you talk with them? Have you found a good way to talk across those divides? Has your own mind ever been changed on an issue? We'd love to hear about it. 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. David, one group you spent some time with were the Deep Canvassers in California. This is really interesting work they've been doing for a number of years now. Can you talk about what deep canvassing is, how it works?
Sure. The one of the most fascinating things, I had no idea this was going to happen. It was very surprising. I wanted to spend time with people who professionally change people's minds. And I spent time with deep canvassing and motivational interviewing and street epistemology and all sorts of other groups. All these groups had never met each other. Many of them were aware of psychological literature that would help explain why, what they did worked. Yet they'd all independently come up with sort of the same approach. And if they had steps in their process, the steps were in the same order. And the first group that I met, it was from the leadership lab at the LGBT Center of Los Angeles. They're sort of the political action wing of that group. And they were trying to understand how Prop 8 had unfolded in California when California voted against same-sex marriage in a state where that just seemed very improbable. And they went door to door to try to figure out what was going on. And they simply asked people at their front doors, why did you vote against this issue? And they were astonished to find that first of all, people were very willing to have that conversation, but also sometimes in talking about the issue, the person at their front door would see it differently by the end of the conversation. So they started recording, and after about 17,000 conversations recorded on video, they A/B tested all of this and threw away what didn't work, kept what did, and they arrived at this really powerful technique they call deep canvassing, which they've now expanded to many different issues, and it's all over the country now. It's not just in California. And it works in a very particular way. I can go through the steps if you'd like, but that's what happened when I went there and canvassed with them, trained in it, went door to door with them, and was just amazed. I went into their archives and watched a lot of the videos and was just astonished to watch people enter the conversation feeling one way and leaving the conversation feeling another. And it's a listening technique more than anything. It's a way to hold space and allow another person to introspect in a very particular way so that they can, in a way, discover their actual belief or their opinion on the matter in a way that isn't received wisdom anymore, isn't signaling in any way, is not an attempt to maintain a reputation or an identity. It's strangely very freeing for the person on the other side.
Yeah, that sounds like it's a really potentially uncomfortable situation. You show up at someone's door and say, hey, let's talk about controversial topic X, Y, or Z. What kind of listening techniques or tools did the canvassers use to sort of get people out of the normal black and white thinking and start getting them to approach it in a different way?
Okay, this is very powerful. And although there are about 9 steps in this, you really only need to come away from this with 2. So anybody listening, these first 2 you can apply today. But the first thing, you know, they did in their technique, they would knock on a person's door and say hello, and they would build rapport very quickly, right off the bat. The idea here is to avoid something in psychology I mentioned earlier called reactance. We all have a really strong motivation to push away any stimulus that threatens our autonomy. And if someone's telling you how to think or how you should think or suggesting you should be ashamed for how you currently think, we will very quickly push back. And then often what happens is then you push back a little harder, and then you enter into a feedback loop that ends with one of these angry, you know, let's agree to disagree kind of things, which I hate that expression, by the way, because obviously we agree to disagree. That's how we started the conversation. The way you get out of this is to assure the other person you're not out to shame them in any way, ask for their consent to explore their reasoning, and be very transparent about what you're up to. And more than anything, express you are curious about why they feel the way they feel, how they feel about the issue at hand. Most people, when it's framed that way, are very eager to then share their view on the issue. And then they take whatever the issue is in particular, and this is the really incredible part of this, is ask, how do you feel on this issue on a scale from 0 to 10? If it's a fact-based issue, you can ask, what's your level of certainty? How certain are you? How confident are you that this is true? But if it's an attitude-based issue, a political issue, oftentimes a wedge issue, you can say, well, like if it's gun control, for example, like a 10 would be all guns in the country need to be destroyed, and if you're found with one, it's a death penalty. And 0 would be you should get a free gun in the mail every week. Where are you on that scale? And oftentimes, this is all it takes to have the conversation that I'm talking about. You can imagine, just if I ask you the last movie that you watched, what would you give it on a scale? If you ask you how did you like it, you'll say yes or no. But if I ask you where would you put yourself on the scale, you say maybe a 7. Then I ask, why a 7? You can feel that feeling that most people have. We begin to think in a very different way. On one of these issues, they ask that, and then if the person is a 7 on the issue, they can ask, why do you feel that way? But then they can also say, why not a 6, why not a 5, or why not an 8, why not a 10? And when this all comes from motivational interviewing, though they weren't aware that's where it comes from, a therapeutic technique where if a person wants to move away from a particular side of that spectrum, you can ask them, why aren't they closer to that side? And oftentimes people will produce their own counter-arguments they may never have articulated before. And those counter-arguments will be something that adds weight to feeling differently about it. In deep canvassing, the next thing they usually do is they share a story about someone who's affected by the issue. Often they show a video. Then they ask for that number a second time. If it's moved, they ask, well, why did it move? And what they're doing constantly here is holding space, not non-judgmentally, compassionately listening to the other person and giving that person a chance to say, why do I feel this way? Why did I move? Why does that number feel right to me? And always repeat it back in their own words, use that person's definitions if they have them, and summarize and repeat in such a way that they feel like they're really being heard and they're really starting to get a chance to truly articulate how they feel. And then you can go further to say, is there a time in your life before you felt that way? Are there examples from your life where you have actually been close to this issue? If not, you'll start to see that it's very received wisdom. If so, oftentimes those stories come into conflict with the attitude that you're portraying. And you just listen in this way. You continuously hold that space. And then at the end, you can share your own story. At the end, you can show where your perspective is at. But you say it in such a way, you say, well, you know, it's fascinating. I find you a very intelligent and reasonable person. It's odd that I see it differently than you. I wonder why we see it so differently. You know, from my perspective, this, this, and this. And at no point in any of that is an argument taking place. At no point are you trying to copy and paste anything out of your head into their head. And they have an incredible success rate with this approach for shifting people around on many different wedge issues.
We're talking with science journalist David McRaney about his new book, How Minds Change. Taking your calls at 800-642-1234. Have you found a good way to talk across divides? Has your own mind been changed on an issue? Why was that? 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Dean Knetter in for Rob Ferret. Right now, we're picking up the conversation with science journalist David McRaney, here today to talk about his book, How Minds Change, The Surprising Science of Belief, Opinion, and Persuasion. We're also taking your calls at 800-642-1234. Let's go to the phones. We have Tom in Burlington. Hi, Tom.
Let me make a little quick comment here. I wrote a musical with Warren Casey, the man who wrote Grease. And when you write a musical, you ask the audience, well, how did you like this show or what did you think about this show? And they always tell you, they tell you what they think you want to hear. And then what he would say, well, how can I make it better? And once you ask them how to make it better, then they say, well, the costume was wrong and the music was a little bit off and this was a little bit there and this was a little bit there. And you finally get to what they really thought about them, your question in the first place. But that's one way of, you know, getting the truth out of people. But the next question I wanted to ask is, if you want to change somebody's mind, do you use logic, go straight at them with logic, or do you skirt around the logic and go in a different direction to kind of change it? It's really, it seems like you can't change people's minds.
Got it, Tom. Thanks for the call. David, Tom, thinking like many people, that logic mm-hmm. should be the place we start. As you've been saying, understanding and getting at experiences and motivations seem to be the more productive way, at least to start understanding each other.
Yeah, you can't go in with logic and facts unless you're in one of these environments where that's sort of the rules of the game, like a good faith environment where, you know, hey, we're going to get behind lecterns, we're going to be in front of an audience, or we are in a scientific circle where we go with hypothesis testing and null hypothesis and evidence, and we're going to go with theories and models, and I'm going to vet you, you're going to vet me. There are plenty of places where that's the right approach. There are philosophical domains where you would go with propositions and use logic almost like a mathematical language. It's a great tool. It's an amazing thing. It's a great invention of the human talent. But most of the time when we're having conversations with people, especially face-to-face, we're going to fall back on much more primates, ultra-social primate evolutionary domains of how people parse language and understand things. And we're going to really have to deal with justifications, you know, like you can think of it like this, like when a person is falling in love with somebody, all the things that they say, why do I like this person, would be like the way they talk, the way they walk, the way they cut their food, the music they listen to, the TV shows they like. Then when they're breaking up with that person, they'll say, why are you breaking up with them? Well, because of the way they talk, the way they walk, the way they cut their food, the dumb music they listen to, the dumb TV shows. The reasons remain the same, the facts remain the same, but the motivation has changed, and the thing we say is the reason for or against can be the exact same reason. That's also true in an argument. That's why in psychology, reasoning should not be confused with reason, the philosophical concept of like intellect and rationality. In psychology, reasoning is simply coming up with reasons for what you think, feel, and believe. We're very good at that. You have to get a step behind that process if you want to get at why a person actually is choosing those reasons out of all the other things they could be saying. And that's the place where you're trying to move the conversation and the techniques that I'm talking about in the book. And I would also note that what your example of, if you ask people why they didn't like it, the play, like you're doing sort of the inverse of what you should do in a motivational interviewing environment, because you're asking them to give you reasons for why they don't like it, and they will. And then they'll walk away with all that articulation. And it's one of those things where if they were a 7 in the movie, you would ask, why not a 4, why not a 3? And now they'll produce arguments in the other direction. Well, I did like this, I did like that, I did like this. And they'll walk away from the conversation having articulated reasons for liking the thing instead of against it.
David, we just have a couple of minutes left, but before we run out of time, I'd like to touch on the story of Charlie that you mentioned in the book. He was a 9/11 conspiracy theorist, very deep, very high profile in that world. came out of it, though, renounced the conspiracy theories. What changed his mind?
Yeah, I explore a couple of people like that in the book. I go to Westboro Baptist Church. I spent time with the Moonies and anti-vaxxers, flat earthers, and Charlie, who is a 9/11 truther. He was. He went on a conspiracy road trip television show, actually, with a group of other people who shared his conspiratorial beliefs. But he was the only one who changed his mind. The others actually walked away from getting all this evidence. They went to the crash sites. They flew airplanes. They did all sorts of things that you would love to do with a person who is deep into conspiracy theory, to show them these really raw facts. And they went away feeling even more strongly about it, whereas he went the other way. He changed his mind. I was very curious about this, and after spending time with people who left conspiratorial groups and cults and pseudo-cults, pretty much the same thing usually happens. There's a onboarding process where people usually have some sort of anxiety or identity issue, or they have some sort of need for validation, or the prejudice that the conspiratorial community that they fall into helps them take those things and solves those drives. It meets their needs in a certain way. And then after that, it's just the community that they stick around for. They really want to stay in that group of people and stay in that group hug. The way out, though, the offboarding process, the off-ramp, for everyone I spoke to and that I met, typically someone outside of that group was non-judgmentally offered to listen to them and see their point of view and revealed to them that there were other groups outside of the group that they were in that they could affirm their values within. And it helps a person see that I do have these core values that are separate from the group, and they could be met in a different way in a different group. And once a person has that sort of social safety net, they have a foot in more than one social world, then all of the inconsistencies and the things that frustrate them and the things about the group that they're in that normally that they would forgive start to become a little bit more unforgivable. In Charlie's case, he was hugging people who had lost family members.
David, I'm so sorry. We were just about out of time. Thanks to our guest, David McRaney, author of the new book, How Minds Change. More coming up on Central Time. Stay with us here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Dean Kinetter, in for Rob Ferret. Now it's time for Food Friday. We're talking about a well-loved classic, sandwiches, and what we can do with them in the summertime. That might mean fresh vegetables, cool wraps, ingredients from your garden or a farmer's market. A Wisconsin sandwich shop manager is with us to talk about all things sandwiches, and we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. What are your favorite summer sandwiches? What ingredients do you like to use in the summer? Maybe that's fresh tomatoes, cucumbers, something else. Do you toast? Do you wrap? What do you think makes for a great sandwich? Give us a call, 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Simon Smith is the manager of Crostini Sandwiches in Madison. Simon, welcome to Central Time.
Hey, Dean. Great to be here. How are you doing today?
I'm doing good. How about yourself?
Oh, very well. Very well. The sun is shining. We just got through the rain here in Madison.
Beautiful day. Happy to have you with us. Simon, I got to start out by asking, is there something you think makes for a good summertime sandwich?
I think that there are two important things that go into making a really good summer sandwich. I think that the first thing you should think about is kind of like you want it to be a little bit of a lighter sandwich, so it doesn't, you know, weigh you down when the sun's out and you're having a great time playing frisbee with the kids or anything. And then the other thing I think about is kind of like, you know, you want it to be like a little zesty or maybe have like a little bit of bite. So I personally really love doing like a Chipotle or, you know, even just having like a lemon as a garnish that you can throw on top of some guacamole.
Interesting. So something a little light, a little refreshing. What are some of the ingredients we can get in that sandwich to sort of keep it light and cool and crisp?
I think that kind of avoiding beef is good. I like going for like tuna, turkey, or chicken for things if you're going to be doing protein. I really love romaine lettuce. I really can't speak enough about romaine lettuce. That's my favorite vegetable of all time. It's pretty basic, but it's got that crunch and that light sweetness that I think is very central to a good summer sandwich.
There are a lot of greens out there, Simon. You've got your romaine, you've got spring mix at the store, you've got spinach, butter lettuce. What is it that really elevates romaine above all those other greens we can find for you?
I think romaine, it really just has a very unique like sweetness to it. I like to call it nature's candy. People consistently talk about raisins being nature's candy, and I will always butt heads with them and go for romaine.
And romaine, it does bring to mind the image of, you know, the TV commercial with the lettuce falling down with water droplets. It does bring to mind that very like summertime sort of vibe.
Exactly.
You also mentioned finding ways to zest up our sandwiches and give them a little bit of a kind of a brighter flavor kick. Lemon and guacamole was one thing I heard. What are some of the other ways you think we can kind of give them a little kick?
You can never go wrong with jalapeno peppers. You can go wrong if you put too many. You don't want to have too much jalapeno. But jalapeno peppers is something that's going to go real well. If you're like a spice fanatic like myself, you could do habanero. There's so many different peppers out there. The kids are getting crazy with those all the time. I think that, you know, you can go for lime juice. Just like, really, that's like something that works with avocado centrally. Zucchini starts with a Z also. Kind of zesty. It's got that crunch that I think like kind of drives home a summer sandwich.
And those peppers, I think even for, you know, balcony gardeners like myself, are kind of a good thing to grow and pick in the summertime. Do you think they're especially good this time of year?
Absolutely. One of my favorite bars in town grows chili peppers and Concord grapes in the back, and I spend way too long back there just eating grapes and having a great time.
We're talking with Simon Smith right now, manager of Crostini's Sandwiches in Madison. On this week's edition of Food Friday, we're talking about sandwiches, summer sandwiches in particular. We'd love to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Do you have a favorite sandwich you reach for in the summertime? What do you like to put on your sandwiches that might come from your garden or farmer's market? If you have a favorite sandwich of all time, summer or not, we want to hear about it. 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Simon, you pointed us to a few recipes that you have on the menu there at Crostini. One of them is a farmer's market sandwich. What goes on to this one?
So the farmer's market, we started out by sauteing green bell peppers, and then we roast some potatoes right next to those. After that, we have like a house spinach spread that we like to do. It's very simple, just a few ingredients, that spinach, garlic mashed up into the olive oil that we top it with, and Parmesan. That's always just, you know, adds a little bit of lightness and levity to the sandwich. On top of that, we're going to throw a seasonal vegetable medley, which currently in the summertime involves carrots, cauliflower, broccoli, and sugar snap peas. That's right up the summer alley. And then additionally, we got zucchini that we're cutting into small medallions on that sandwich.
Wow. And you mentioned those green peppers and sauteing them. About how long do you saute them for? Sometimes when I try to put peppers on a sandwich, I find they get a little slidey, maybe a little bit too wet on the sandwich. Any tips for sauteing peppers that go on a sandwich?
I think that it's about high heat and low time. Personally, like that's how we work it, because we just throw them on the flat top grill that we've got, and so it's always running at a really high heat. And by the time that like an egg is ready to flip, because the farmer's market, I like to eat it as a breakfast sandwich and throw a couple eggs on there. Mm. I think that by the time the eggs are ready to flip, that's when I like to pull the peppers.
Sounds delicious. We have a caller with us. We have Lottie in Silver Lake. Hi, Lottie.
Yeah, hey, this is just what I like to put on almost any sandwich. I like potato chips. I prefer original Ruffles potato chips, and top that off with some Catalina salad dressing or French salad dressing, or as far as personal preference, any kind of potato chips or salad dressing. My preference would be Ruffles potato chips and Catalina dressing on top, and the potato chips offer the crunch and Catalina offers a little bit of a zingy flavor to it. It works out really well.
And Lottie, do you put that on a sandwich with meat? Is that on PB&J or just about anything?
just about anything. I like it with meat, like ham sandwich. I would add on there. I know you said stay away from beef, but I like beef sandwiches or just about anything, actually. I don't know. I'd probably stay away from some kind of a tuna thing or whatever, but mostly regular ham sandwiches or, you know, even hot dogs in the summertime. You cut them, slice them down the middle, make a hot dog sandwich or whatever.
Got it. Lottie, thanks for the call at 800-642-1234. Simon, your thoughts on potato chips or, in generally, adding a crunch to a sandwich?
Well, that's awesome. It's always great to meet another crunch fanatic, you know? And I totally agree about Ruffles because I think the ridges are what make a good potato chip.
Nice. And sometimes that that crunch can really, especially in the summertime, like we've been talking about with romaine or zucchini, really add a lot to the texture of a sandwich.
I can't believe that I even forgot about potato chips or tortilla chips, because what I like to do is I'll cut a tortilla up and then I'll just throw it in the fryer, and that comes out perfect for like topping a salad or throwing into like a wrap or something like that.
Really, just a tortilla itself and then fry it up and you got something crunchy?
Exactly, exactly. If you pull them out at the right time, you can find a nice balance between like very crunchy and a little bit of that like tortilla consistency that's very fluffy.
Something else you've got on the menu is a Chipotle chicken wrap, and wraps are really good for the summertime. Can you tell us a little bit about how this one comes together?
So this one comes together. We start with the tortilla. We've got bacon that we're throwing on the grill, and we're going to throw the chicken on next to it. I still do not know the recipe for the Chipotle mayo that we have. The owner, the chef, really is very secretive about all the condiment recipes. But I know that it's a fantastic Chipotle aioli. I haven't had anything else that pairs with it. I think that is like the single condiment that's kept me working at this place for so long.
Wow. Any other favorite condiments that you like to throw on? I know there's a wide variety out there.
Italian dressing is always good. I like to do that like on top of some coleslaw with some brisket. That's like a personal favorite of mine, is make like a brisket taco and throw coleslaw on top of there, and then Italian dressing on top of that with a little bit of barbecue sauce and some cheddar cheese. That I like to call that the smokestack. That's something that we have off the menu because I'm really the only one eating that. Other things that I like for dressings, the Cubano sauce is very classic, just like a spicy mustard with like a mayo base and Dijon. Then you throw in whatever hot sauce you got will work for that. Cubano sauce can go on just about anything. I love dipping French fries in there.
Central Time producer Rachel Vasquez just sent us a message. Says mayo, the only condiment you need on sandwiches or in life. So mayo, I know some people love it. Some people can, you know, leave it. Are there ways to kind of dress mayo up, even if we've just got it in the fridge, a way we can kind of elevate it a bit?
Well, if you're feeling like you're missing McDonald's, all you got to do is mix mayo and ketchup and you got Big Mac sauce.
Oh, that's simple, eh?
Mm-hmm. They won't like me saying that, but, you know, McDonald's is a big conglomerate, and I say anyone can make their own Big Mac sauce if they got the determination.
Peeling back the curtain this week on Food Friday, we're talking about sandwiches, especially summer sandwiches. Simon Smith, manager of Crostini Sandwiches in Madison, is with us this week. We want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Do you have any tips for elevating basic sandwiches or making a sandwich extra summery? Anything you're picking out of your garden or your local farmer's market that you like to put on a sandwich? And hey, if you've got a favorite sandwich of all time, summer or otherwise, let us know about it. 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas@wpr.org. We'll continue the conversation and hear from you coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Dean Kinetter. Right now, we're picking up our talk about summertime sandwiches with Simon Smith, manager of Crostini Sandwiches in Madison. And we're taking your calls about your favorite sandwiches, your favorite things to put on sandwiches during the summertime. The number is 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Let's go to the phones now. We have Laura with us in Madison. Laura, hi.
Hi.
What's your recommendation?
Hi. One of my family's favorite summertime sandwiches is grilled mahi-mahi with a quick pickled onion on a ciabatta roll.
Wow. And anything else you like to put on that, Laura, or just those three and you're set?
We put a little rub on the mahi-mahi, so it's a little spicy. So it's got that kick that you were talking about earlier, and it's very light. And I think one thing I'd like to say is the bread really matters.
Sounds delicious. Laura, thanks for the call. Simon, what do you think about some fish on a sandwich and that ciabatta bread?
That sounds fantastic. And talk about, like, ciabatta with mahi-mahi. I feel like those two textures would just align very perfectly. Very perfectly. That's a great sandwich. I'm going to have to bring that back to the restaurant.
And that softer ciabatta bread with kind of a softer protein there, the mahi-mahi, is that a good idea to sort of, you know, match the softer inside, a softer outside of the sandwich in general?
I think that that's something you can really play around with, but it makes it just like a very easy to eat sandwich, you know, something that like you can have and not really have to worry too much about putting in a lot of work. I've had sandwiches on like very hard baguettes a few times, and you kind of like, it feels like you're like a lion in like a nature documentary kind of, you know? And I enjoy not having to put in a lot of work to eat my food.
Absolutely. Let's go next to Jimbo in Plover. Jimbo, hello.
No, hey, how's it going, guys?
Good. What's
hey,
on your
Jimbo?
Mind?
Hey, up in Plover here, but so I learned this from my nephews. You crush up Doritos. You put Cool Ranch, spicy Doritos in your sandwich. And the other thing is mayonnaise and peanut butter. But you got to put them on both sides of the sandwich, not together. And I'll listen to you guys talk. Take it easy, guys.
Thanks, Jimbo, for the call. That might be a hot take there, Simon. What do you think?
Man, now I'm just thinking about if you put Doritos and Cool Ranch Doritos on a mayo and peanut butter sandwich?
The possibilities are truly becoming endless here this week.
Absolutely.
Let's go next to Ken, calling us from Wausau today. Hi, Ken.
Good morning. I guess it's afternoon. I'm calling because I think perhaps the most important piece of a sandwich is the bread. And someone just mentioned ciabatta a little bit, but there's nothing better than the bread. In fact, just toasted bread with butter is a great sandwich. But if you're starting to think about sourdough bread or Irish soda bread, those are great. So it doesn't matter what you put in the side. Those are great.
Got it. Ken, thanks for the call. And Simon, we haven't dived too deep into the bread yet. What kind of breads are your favorites to work with at Christini?
We use just Italian white bread, which is like kind of like the bigger loaves for every single panini. I'm a huge fan of brioche buns for doing sandwiches, kind of like, you know, like a chicken filet sandwich. I think brioche is like almost always my go-to when it comes to that. I'm always looking for the word brioche if I'm ordering a burger anywhere. Other than that, like sourdough is amazing. A whole wheat is surprisingly just, in addition to being healthy for you, it lends a lot of texture. You get those oats on the sides. Sometimes you'll find like a nut. I love maple nut is the bread that I keep stacked at my house all the time when I want to make like a peanut butter banana sandwich.
Maple nut. I imagine that adds a little bit of sweetness to that peanut butter banana too.
Absolutely. You know, just a little bit of the kicker that you need so you don't have to put too much honey on there.
Honey, I was just going to recommend that. I'm a big fan of the PB and banana myself, and that honey is really where it's at.
Mm-hmm.
Ken, thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. Still time if you have any sandwich recommendations, questions about sandwiches, 800-642-1234. Ken also mentioned toasting bread, really elevating it. I second that, Ken. I think that's a great idea. And I know that you do that with the paninis where you're at, Simon.
Yeah, everything is pressed on a panini press for that, and all of the sub sandwiches we make, we offer them toasted or not toasted. Personally, I think it's a little bit the same line as when someone gets pasta. This is a little off topic, but we offer either French bread or garlic bread. I think that you should always go for the garlic bread, in my opinion. So, like, having an untoasted sub sandwich, I feel like you should almost always have it toasted, unless there's the one exception which I think an Italian sub, you should never toast an Italian sub because you want to have that like softer bread feel.
And for those of us in the home setting who may not have a panini press, but still like, you know, good toasted sandwich, is there a best way to go about it? Is it toaster, oven, broiler? What tips do you have?
So I would recommend just putting it into like an oiled, like on an oiled skillet. And it's funny, but if you have like kind of just like a flat piece of metal, like a little piece of sheet metal or something that's heat resistant, you know, that'll also like collect heat, something that, you know, won't get damaged or burnt. All you got to do then is if you have like kettlebells or something heavy, you can put it on top of that and it works like a panini press at your house.
Interesting. So in the skillet, they're taking a little bit of like the grilled cheese model and bringing it over to other sandwiches.
Exactly. Just doing it like that. And if you're ever cooking burgers or like a grilled cheese, throw a pot lid over it on the pan. And that way all the heat kind of conducts around it. It'll melt everything evenly.
Huh. Interesting. Yeah. The timing of melting the cheese on a burger has always kind of been challenging for me. So I'm going to give that a try next time. We are going to go next to Jared in Stoughton. Hey, Jared.
Well, hello there. So I have a sandwich that I grew up eating. We didn't have a lot of money, so you kind of made do. And I am definitely a Miracle Whip guy. So I would take white bread and you lightly toast it, barely brown. Miracle Whip on both sides. And then you stack 1.5 to 2 inches of crispy iceberg lettuce in the middle. And you get that tang from the Miracle Whip and you get all that crunch from the salad and the lettuce. It's so good.
Jared, thanks for the call. Simon, sometimes simple can be just what we need.
Absolutely. At night, I'm a bartender, and three ingredient recipes are my favorite. I think that is true with sandwiches as well. Jared, I'm going to have to try that the next time I go grocery shopping. Got to pick up some iceberg.
Nice. Jared, thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. We'll go next to Suzanne driving on I-90. Hi, Suzanne.
Hi. So my husband is from England, and he makes something called saucy sandwiches, and it is just Worcestershire sauce on bread.
That's it, huh? Anything else on there?
Nope, it's just that.
And have you tried this, Suzanne? Do you back your husband's recipe?
No, I refuse.
Got it. Suzanne, thanks for letting us know about that. Simon, if we're not using Worcester sauce by itself, is there anything else we can put it on that can really work?
Most of the experience I have with Worcestershire is using it in, I think it's used in hollandaise. So I'll just dip asparagus in something that has it.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. That's good stuff.
I should say one thing. Mm-hmm. Suzanne, I hope you have a lovely marriage and don't let that sandwich get in between you. Just make sure that you're not watching him eat it.
That's right. We don't need sandwiches coming in between anything here. Simon, before we run out of time, I want to talk about the cran apple turkey chutney panini that you told us about. Tell us about what goes into this one and why it's so tasty.
So this one, we're going to start it out with thinly sliced turkey, and we've got a house cranberry apple chutney, which is just we slow cook those together and add a little, like a very slight amount of sugar. The cranberry, you need to add the sugar to balance out the cranberry. And then that just, it's a very simple sandwich. It's a panini, and we've got provolone spinach spread. I already talked about the spinach spread. It's got garlic, olive oil, and Parmesan. And then we throw some onions on there. Not green onions. It's got white onions. So it just kind of has like a very like spring, summery kind of like lights up your mouth, like kind of like, you know, a bunch of flavors popping all over the place.
Wow, that sounds really good. Nice and tart. And, you know, we haven't even talked about cheese. There's a lot to get into. But Simon, it's been a lot of fun. Thank you for joining us today. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Dean. Have a great day.
You too. That was Simon Smith, manager of Christini Sandwiches in Madison. He talked with us on this week's edition of Food Friday, all about great sandwiches for the summertime. And if you have any more recommendations, you can keep letting us know over on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Coming up Monday on The Morning Show with Kate Archer Kent, The Vinyl Resurgence. Record shops are seeing demand for vinyl at its highest point in years. We'll hear from two Wisconsin guests about what's behind the trend, and we'll want to hear about your favorite record finds. Plus, the head of the state broadband task force talks about the progress they're making on bringing high-speed internet to more Wisconsinites. That and more coming up Monday after 7 on The Morning Show. When you think of hazards on a golf course, trees, sand, and water probably come to mind. But in yesterday's first round of the Open Championship in St. Andrews, Scotland, a straight drive by Rory McIlroy came to a sudden stop against an ancient stone. Some context. St. Andrews is known as the home of golf, where it's been played since at least the 1600s. And long ago, the course boundary was marked by stones, with a G on one side for golf and a C on the other for common ground. These days, they're protected by plastic covers. But since the course expanded in the 1800s, a few of those stones are in the dead center of their fairways, making them a great target. So, if you're ever teeing it up in Scotland, aim for the stones and hope you hit it perfect. Well, almost perfect. This is Central Time.